You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Living an active lifestyle is one way to keep ourselves healthy and mobile as we age. But as our bodies change with time, our fitness routines may have to change along with it. Our next guest is a physical therapy expert joining us with advice on how to adapt our exercise habits so we can stay active well into old age. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How have your exercise habits changed as you age? What are some activities you've been able to keep doing as you've gotten older? What are some you've left behind? Or have you found new ways to get exercise over the years or decades? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carlin Ault is a clinical associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Milwaukee. Carlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we get into the how, let's talk a little bit about the why. Carlin, what are the benefits of keeping exercise going, keeping fitness going as we get older?
Well, as we age, our muscles and bones can change a little bit, and it's important to stay strong, especially in those functional muscle groups that help us get up and down off of the ground, get in and out of chairs, cars, those sorts of things. And it is true, if you don't use it, you will lose it. So it's especially important through the aging process to continue to load our muscles and bones and continue to push ourselves so we have the stimulus to add more muscle and bone.
You know, the workout my 20-year-old daughters might be doing now might not be right for me. How do we evaluate as we get older, you know, this is the appropriate thing to accomplish those goals you just lined out? This maybe isn't the thing I do anymore.
Well, of course, everything is individualized. If you have any underlying conditions or you're on certain medications, those things can make a difference. But you may be able to do a lot of the exercises that your 20-year-old daughter is doing. So don't sell yourself short. We want to make sure that we're continuing to strengthen our muscles. And the good news is, while we have some physiological and biological changes in our tissues with aging, the good news is those tissues are still very responsive to appropriate loading. So you can add muscle mass, you can add some strength to your bone, or slow down the rate of the decline by staying active. I always like to say we all need to move more and sit less. And anything that you do is better than nothing. So that's a good place to start.
That is. Let's talk about strength a little bit. You mentioned some key muscle groups for doing things like getting up and down, things like that. What are some of the muscle groups we might focus on? What are some good entry points to exercising those zones?
Yeah, that's a great question. I focus a lot on sit to stand or being able to get up off of the floor. As we're aging, or really at any age, we can sometimes find ourselves on the floor. But as you are aging and becoming a little bit weaker, which is part of the normal aging process, is you do lose some muscle mass, to make sure you're focusing on the muscles that are used for functional tasks. So if you're sitting in a chair and you stand up, you need your glutes, which is your backside, and your quads on the front of your thigh to be able to help you lift your body weight to be able to stand up. So anything that's involving some sit to stand activities are very important for those muscle groups. Also, the outside of your hips, when we walk, we stand on one leg for part of the time and we're swinging the other leg. So making sure the outside of our leg muscles are nice and strong so we stay stable. It's all about reducing your risk of having a fall, because falls can really disrupt your life, and staying strong will allow you to be able to better able to catch yourself or prevent yourself from falling. But at least if you find yourself on the floor, you've got the muscle strength to get back up.
And then how about keeping our cardiovascular exercise going over time?
Yeah, that's another great question. So a muscle is muscle. So the heart is a muscle, and we have to exercise that just like we exercise our peripheral muscles. And the target heart rate you want to work hard enough that you're challenging your muscles, whether it's a muscle in your thigh or your heart muscle. So we always do need to be pushing ourselves a little bit above what our daily level of function is. For cardiovascular exercise, you want to be trying to get around 60 to 80% of your heart rate for whatever period of time you can do that for. the guideline is 150 minutes per week of moderate physical activity. So if you break that up, if you're doing a little over 30 minutes or so per day of aerobic physical activity, that is a good place to start. But you'd like to push yourself a little more than just what you're typically used to doing.
Talking to Carlin Ault, clinical associate professor at UW-Milwaukee on physical therapy, talking about our changing exercise and fitness needs as we age. You can join in with your questions or your story at 800-642-1234. James is with us now in Fountain City. James, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. Say, I'm 75, and I started with endurance sports, in the late 70s or so, doing Birkebeiners, cross-country ski races all of the Midwest, and I've continued on mountain bike series. In fact, I'm on my way right now to a canoe workout, which is pretty intense canoeing since I live near Winona and the home of Winona Canoes. And plus, I'm a master swimmer. All I can say for people listening to this is you don't quit. You know, you don't quit unless you literally can't get up off a chair, but I'm a big proponent of staying active. I mean, I lift at the Y, I do all these things. I don't know where I got that from. Must be genetics or something, but.
I think it helps if it's fun too, right? Mm-hmm. When it's a fun activity, it's a lot easier for you to go out and participate. I also think it's wonderful that you're doing a great combination of upper extremity exercises. Canoeing is going to work your arms and your upper body. Swimming is upper body. Cross-country skiing, biking, both lower extremity exercises. They'll all get your heart working with cardiovascular work, and none of them are really jarring or loading to your lower extremity joints. Some people can develop some arthritis and some pain in their hips and knees with the aging process. You don't have to, but some people do. Those individuals would tolerate something like skiing or biking better than running and jogging. So picking the type of exercise, even though it's in a category of aerobic or strength training, is important.
James, thanks a lot for sharing that. Keep it up. Now, James is a wee bit older than I am. I'm not doing anywhere near as much exercise as James is. Carlin, I do walk a fair amount. I don't know. Does walking count?
Oh, that's a great question. Walking can count for general exercise outside. So if you're walking at a pace where you're starting to breathe a little bit heavier, you can carry on a conversation, but you're not huffing and puffing. That's probably moderate intensity, and there's nothing wrong with doing that if your goal is to get outside, work your heart muscle a little bit. If you wanted to be making your bones stronger or adding mass to your muscles, you would need to do something a little bit more than that. Doesn't mean that walking's not good. It means you can maybe mix and match different activities so you can accomplish all the goals that you're looking for. For adding some strength to your bones, you really need a little more impact. So you could walk maybe with trekking poles, and you'd be pounding your poles into the pavement while you're walking. That would be more of an impact load, if that makes sense.
Sure. Let's go to another caller now. Lyric is with us in Blanchardville. Lyric, hi.
Hi. A few years ago, I got injured and had a brain concussion, and the best medicine for me was that walking in water the Upland Hills and Dodgeville has, where you walk across the floor to an area and it lowers down into a pool that's about 9 feet wide and maybe 16 feet long. The water, if your knees or your ankles are injured, the water supports your body weight, and in front of you is a bar that you can hang on if you've got a balance problem, so you feel very safe. You can tell them how high you want the jets of water that are moving in the pool and how deep you want it. But my favorite thing was that the endorphins that your body gets when you're walking in that water is like the best antidepressant in the world, and it lasts 2 or 3 days at least. It's wonderful.
Lyric, thank you so much for sharing that. And that's, Carlin, for people who can't have a lot of impact, that could be a great option, it sounds like.
That is a great option. And she's absolutely right that when you can participate in an activity that makes you feel good and you do have the endorphin release, you know you're doing something positive for your body. But when it's fun and it's enjoyable, you're going to stick with it. And of course, for all of us, that's the real trick, is being able to find something that we can continue to do because it's fun and we enjoy it and it makes us feel good.
Lyric, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Carlin Ault, clinical professor of physical therapy at UW-Milwaukee, about how to adapt our exercise habits, our fitness routines as we get older to help keep us mobile and healthy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What goals do you have for remaining active as you age? Are there recreational or practical activities that you're worried about having to leave behind? Our guest might be able to help you find something that could replace it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Carlin Ault, Clinical Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about how we can change our workout, our fitness routine as we get older, so we can continue to live active and healthy lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a lifelong exerciser? How did that change over the years, if at all? Have you hit an age where you're thinking, I got to start doing some stuff? Because you have a sedentary normal person job like radio host. I don't know. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello. Yes. Thanks for taking the call. Anyways, I'm 60 this year, and during COVID, I tried seeing what retiring would look like, and I can't do it. And so I gave up my job that I had, and now I'm back into construction. I'll tell you what, it was hard getting going, but daggone it, I've never felt this good in my life. You know,
Jim, did you do exercise, apart from the exercise involved in the construction work itself? Like, were you doing stuff to build up to that?
Yeah. During the winter, I went ahead because they don't hire in the winter. So during the winter, I got a membership at the Y, and I made sure that I was, you know, doing the treadmills, walking the block around here, lifting a little weight to try and make sure that I wasn't going to strain something right out the gate. But, yeah.
I love it, Jim. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Carl, it sounds like Jim was really smart about getting back into construction work there.
Yeah, yes, construction is certainly a physical job that will keep you using your muscles most definitely. One comment I do want to add to what Jim said is that the target, if most of us are going to the gym and working on muscle strengthening, we want to make sure that we're working hard enough that we're going to get some benefit out of it. And that is, in physical therapy term, we'd be looking at like 60 to 80% of your one rep max, meaning the most that you can lift. But that's a little complicated for most of us to do when we go to the gym. But if you think about it in the number of repetitions you could do on an exercise, if I'm doing bicep curls to make my bicep, my upper arm stronger, I should be lifting a weight that's heavy enough that by the time I get to number 10, I could almost not do one more repetition. If I'm aiming for 10 repetitions, I'm probably at about 75% of my one rep max, which means I'm going to be giving my body a stimulus to add more muscle, add more protein. Anywhere between 8 and 12 is good, but 10 is kind of around that sweet spot. So that might help people, is if you can do 30 and you think you're adding muscle mass, you need to push yourself a little harder with a heavier weight so you can't do quite so many reps. That's the stimulus to add your muscle. And I'm sure that Jim is doing that when he's working construction, lifting heavy loads.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Kenny is with us now in Rice Lake. Kenny, hi. Are you there, Kenny?
Yeah.
Hi. What did you want to tell us about?
I'm a welder by trade, and oftentimes in the shop I work in, I hear from the gentleman my age or in our 60s that all you need to do is work hard, and that's going to help you stay in good shape. When I've learned over the years that I like to go to the gym and work out, ride bicycle and do aerobic activities, and it seems to keep you in much better shape than just, quote, working hard.
All right. And Kenny, have you talked your coworkers into going biking with you or hitting the gym with you?
Well, you know, they just don't seem to be really responsive to that. They don't want to jump in and go to the spin class at the gym, but maybe they will.
All right. Tell them we sent you, Kenny. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Carlin, again, Kenny seems to be on the right track here.
Yeah, we have. Of course, we have wonderful listeners on public radio.
Yes.
They're all exercising. Terrific.
Kenny, thanks for the call. Carlin, one zone of exercise we haven't talked about a ton yet related to, you were talking about falls earlier, is balance. Now, when people are in their teens and 20s, they might not be thinking about balance as an exercise issue. Why does that get important? What can we do about it?
Balance is really important. Single leg balance, because if you think about standing at home and getting dressed, you're standing on one leg and have to put your leg through the other leg of the pant, or you have to sit down to be able to do that. So balance is important for walking, for transitions, for slippery surfaces. Often, you know, getting up from sit to stand, you might have been dozing and you're startled. It's a real it's a danger zone when you're making transitions between sit to stand, and that does relate to balance. In addition to just having good muscle strength and the ability to kind of take all of your weight, our vision changes, our hearing changes. We might have a lot of wax built up in our ears. The vestibular system and your visual system also play a role in balance. I often think of getting up to go to the bathroom at night. If your house is completely dark, you have taken away, you're a little bit groggy, and you've taken away that visual system from being able to help you with your balance. So I am a big fan of night lights for the aging population, so that as you take away some of those other supports for you to maintain good balance, vision and your vestibular system, that you're supporting yourself if you've got any changes in diabetes or poor range of motion in your legs that can affect your balance.
Talking to Carlin Ault from UW-Milwaukee, physical therapist there, talking about our changing exercise and fitness needs as we age. Back to your calls now with Kim in Mequon. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I have been a lifelong exerciser. I am 69 this year. I still downhill ski, cross-country ski, ride my bike. I mean, I started riding a bike in my teens. I have three bikes. I still ride them. I rode my bike to work today and back. And my job is teaching fitness classes for seniors. So I cannot tell you how many times I've had someone come to the classes new and start working out. We do weight training. We do a little cardio. And they will come back to me like 3 or 4 months later and say, hey, I just went to my doctor. And my doctor's like, what are you doing? Keep it up. Your blood pressure's down. You know, your stats are really, really good. So I just want to say, if anybody is a little older and hasn't worked out for a long time, don't let that stop you, because you can get back into the game.
Kim, thanks a lot for the call and the inspiration. Carlin, Kim pointing toward even within a few months, apparently doctors noticing a difference when people get back into exercise.
Yeah, and absolutely. And there are some studies that will show that even into your 90s, you can add muscle mass. So that the body is very adaptive. And so you can start at any age and you will see changes. It does take... you know, 6 weeks at least to start to get muscle mass changes, but you can see improvements sooner than that. It's more of a neuromuscular training effect, but absolutely, you can see physical changes, body changes, strength, endurance changes, and you just overall, you feel better. And I will put in a little plug for protein, because as we age, the body's ability to, the amount of protein that we need to take in to help build our muscles, that changes a little bit. So everyone, but especially our older adults, need to be eating protein with just about every meal, because that's helping to maintain that muscle health and muscle strength.
Kim, thanks again for the call and the inspiration. Carlin, you mentioned, you know, people may have some different needs when it comes to exercise. I wanted to ask you about one of your specialties. You work with people on exercise and fatigue for survivors of cancer. What kind of different things might be at play there?
Well, cancer itself and all of the treatments for cancer can affect multiple systems in the body, can affect your heart muscle, so cardiovascular system. You can have loss of extensibility, so things end up getting a little bit tight, can have some changes in your bone. So all systems can be affected either through cancer and or cancer treatment. And for some reason, we tend to not, we meaning the medical system, don't always routinely refer our patients who are undergoing or have completed treatment for cancer to physical therapy to get people back strength, muscle strength, cardiovascular conditioning. We don't do it in the same way that we do for heart attacks or for strokes or amputations. And that's really my mission, is to make sure that all cancer survivors, because there's millions of them, are treated with specific exercise to help people return back to a highly functional life. It's not just about surviving the treatment. It's about returning to thriving and having a really high quality of life, being strong and being able to enjoy every day because you do feel good.
Carlin, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Carlin Ault, Clinical Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at UW-Milwaukee. We talked to her today about how we can change our workout and fitness routines as we get older to help keep us active, hopefully for years to come. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Teen and preteen years can be difficult under any circumstances. At times confusing, scary, exciting, you name it, for both kids and their parents or guardians. Now throw in the online world and social media, where kids grow up in a lot of ways in public. A lot of parents wonder how to help their kids manage all that without becoming 24/7 monitors of their online activity. Our next guest has advice, and she says it starts with mentoring, modeling, and building trust. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you talk to your kids about what they do online? What questions do you have about how to talk to your kids about what they do online? Has having kids with the internet made parenting easier, harder for you? If you are a young person yourself or were recently a teenager, love to hear your experiences navigating the world of social media and how your parents may have helped or hindered that. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Devorah Heitner is an author and speaker on technology and parenting in the digital age. She consults with schools about digital wellness policies and with app developers and tech companies on ethical practices. Her books include Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Her newest book is called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Devorah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, you write that you are, like me, a parent who grew up before the social media age, where we could make mistakes and know that they weren't going to go viral. Is there kind of a communication gap between, you know, parents of the pre-internet generation and the kids growing up just swimming in this stuff?
I think there is. And there's absolutely a lot of worry on parents' part that kids can go viral. And I think because we all lived our own mistakes in middle school, high school, and even college, we're very aware of the sort of youthful, dumb, indiscreet things that might happen and that we know, you know, are kind of universally part of growing up even. And so it makes us really nervous. A lot of parents are very nervous to think about the fact that a video or a photo of, you know, your kid that their friend posts could become a huge problem because it's so much more searchable and shareable than anything dumb that we did.
You get a lot of questions from parents, you write, that are pretty nuts and bolts. You know, should I use this kind of monitoring thing? Should I bar kids from using this platform? Whatever. And we'll talk some about those things. But you, I think, started a more fundamental place about how to parent to prepare kids for dealing with these issues. A shift, you say, from consequences to building character. Can you talk about what you have in mind?
Absolutely. You want to think about not, you won't get into an elite college if you post that because that's an external threat. And that's basically telling kids, don't get caught. What we actually want to say is don't do harm. Don't do things, you know, on Discord, on Instagram, on YouTube, on TikTok that are harmful, right? Don't malign a group of people or an individual. Don't do things that you know will cause hurt feelings or worse. Don't incite violence, right? And these are things that we know are really problematic. And we don't want to say, don't do it because Harvard might rescind your admission. We want to say, don't do it because we don't want to cause harm. And we don't want to share things that might cause people to have the wrong idea about us and who we are. So if we can keep the conversation focused on character, it's more accurate, it's more developmentally appropriate, it's more true, because frankly, you might do something that's pretty terrible and still get into an elite school and they just won't know. But that's, as a parent, that doesn't make me happy. I'm not like, oh, great, you got away with it, right? The point is, who are you as a human being? So I think we need to shift that conversation to character and away from the threat of consequences.
I remember my teen years. I was not all that bright. I made dumb decisions sometimes impulsively. I'm sure if I had social media, I would have amplified them quite a bit. How do we work with a preteen or a teen to, I guess, take that step to not be impulsive, to think about a consequence before doing stuff online?
It's tricky because it really does go against their neurobiology to not be impulsive. You know, teenagers are wired to think more about the rewards than the long-term consequences of an action. And so what we have to do is try to save them from themselves. And some of that maybe is not amplifying when teenagers make mistakes. We don't need to participate in amplifying that to reduce the harm factor. We can also look at things like in the UK and Europe, kids have the right to be forgotten. They can take things down that they posted when they were under 18. The realities of that with the internet, and I've talked to UK folks about this, it doesn't really fully work if your kid's involved in a tremendous scandal. It's still hard to pull that off the internet. But I do think the idea of thinking about not creating a permanent record of every dumb joke you ever said starting when you were 11 or 13 is a good one. And we as parents and educators in the US should be thinking about, like, what can we do from a policy perspective? Because the neurobiology and the technology, you know, intersect in a way that's pretty dicey for our kids.
One option people might think is maybe let's get out of the whole thing altogether. Say, kid, no device, no social media for you. Problem solved. What do you think of that approach?
I don't think that's a good strategy. I think kids need to know how to be citizens in digital communities. We can't just launch them at 18 and let them go off the deep end then. If anything, it's better to make your mistakes when you're young and learn about accountability in a digital community and communication strategies that work and how to resolve conflict when you're young enough to have a little bit more sort of forgivability, if you will, and a little bit less at stake. Like, say you're not going to hopefully blow up your career at 14, right? Hopefully that's,
I hope,
you know, still to come. So I think it's really important that we do teach kids how to be part of digital communities. I don't think we should push them in before they're ready, but I think school can be a great place to learn, for example, how to be part of a hangout or, you know, a shared document or other things in a community where you actually know the people involved before you get into digital communities where you don't know the other people, because that's sort of a next level experience. And ideally, we can scaffold kids' experience growing more and more familiar with how to be participants in a digital community in a way that's appropriate.
Talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, maybe your own experiences as a parent or teen yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. Devorah, I didn't end up doing a lot of monitoring with my kids. They're 20 now, so they're out the door. But I was amazed reading your chapter on options available for parents. There's a lot of ways to keep tabs on our kids online and social media and geolocation and so on and so forth. What do you recommend as parents survey that and think, yeah, maybe I should do this?
I think it's more important to talk to your kids and have a trusting, open relationship with your kids than anything else. And I think if you do monitor them, say you have a new phone user, I would do it with them. Like, if they're new at it and you want to look at their text with them, let's sit down together and look at your texts once a week or something until I see that you've got this. I don't think we want to use technology to surveil our kids, and particularly we don't want to do it covertly. If we are monitoring, they should know we're monitoring. And in situations where they are being monitored by a third party like school, I do think it's fair to remind kids, hey, you know what, if you post this in the school Google chat, right, your teacher can see it. Like, I do think when kids are being monitored, they should know. If we covertly monitor our kids and go kind of all NSA, KGB on our kids, whatever, we are going to have a lot of data that we won't know what to do with. And the first time we share it with them, we're no longer covertly monitoring. We've ruptured trust, and we're often catching kids after they've made the mistake instead of before. What we want to do is teach kids how to make good choices, let them come to us if they've made a mistake that they need to kind of repair or move forward from. And we don't want to teach them that they can never repair a digital mistake. We've all made digital mistakes. Everyone listening to this has at least forgotten to BCC at some point and CC people and shared an email address with someone they shouldn't, or, you know, posted news on LinkedIn that wasn't public yet, or just something, right? I'm not saying, you know, tremendous digital mistakes, but we've all made some digital mistakes. And I think it's important that we don't teach kids that those can never be solved and they should be terrified, because in the most extreme scenario, that means that a kid who makes a digital mistake might feel desperate enough to contemplate ending their own life. What we want to do is obviously try to avoid the worst digital mistakes, talk to kids about planning for that, but also talk to them about how we can move forward and repair if we do share something we shouldn't.
One starting point that I loved in your book was not so much about what the kids are posting, but what the parents are posting about the kids. And of course, parents want to post baby pictures through graduation pictures and everything. You talk about the idea of, you know, negotiations as a family for what a kid is comfortable being posted about them and what they aren't. How do we approach that?
I think we need to be asking our kids' permission by the time they can talk to us and give it. And when they're too little for that, we should, if in doubt, not share it out. Picture that 3-year-old running around in their underpants being adorable as a someday very self-conscious 13-year-old who will not appreciate that video being out there. So, you know, if in doubt, do not share it out. And by asking permission from our kids, we're actually setting up really great boundaries, and we're teaching them that we respect their privacy, and we're giving them the opportunity to recognize that you ask permission before you share someone's picture, which is something we want them to know before they start taking and sharing pictures of their friends.
We're talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you dealt with this in your family, whether you're the parent or the kid, or a parent who used to be a kid dealing with these issues? What kind of boundaries, what kind of rules, what kind of conversations do you have in your household? What do you think about various ways to monitor kids' online activities? Do you need some advice from our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Devorah Heitner about a new book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World, packed with advice for parents and teens and preteens about how to handle social media and the digital world. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're taking our lesson to not share information publicly to heart, but if you have a story you'd be willing to share, like to share, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a difficult experience with a teen posting something online that maybe they shouldn't have oughta? How did you handle that? What kind of things did you do to prepare your kids, or prepare if you were the kid in this situation yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. So what do we do, Devorah, when the bad thing happens? The kid posts something and it goes, you know, maybe not even internationally viral, but in their school viral or something like that, and causes harm and a lot of attention. How can we do some triage and try to fix things?
Yeah, I mean, I shared the story of the kids in Baraboo in the book, and some of you will remember that that's a situation where, you know, there was a photo in the community and some kids were making either white supremacist signs or a kind of Nazi Heil Hitler you know, arm gesture, and it went around the world. And there are all kinds of ways that, you know, in the postmortem, we could think like they could have done better in that community to deal with what happened. But I think we all learn from situations like that. One of the tricky things is when something gets really big and it becomes national or international news, it becomes harder to have honest conversations in a community that might need to happen. Like there were kids in that community who wanted to apologize and make amends and repair, which is what I think they should have happened and what in some cases did happen. And that's what I would want, you know, any kid to have the opportunity to do if they realize like, wow, I made this significant error. I've hurt people by doing this. I want to come forward. But when it becomes a sort of media circus, it becomes harder because parents are like, want you to sort of stay away and hide. They don't want their kid to become known for this. So they don't want the kid to even come forward and apologize. So I think we need to make sure that kids have a way to make repair, make restitution as much as possible in the time and in the community where it happens. And then we need to let it go and move on, right? We need to make sure kids don't sort of pay and pay for the rest of their lives for like this one thoughtless moment, even though it's serious. Like I'm not saying, and I want to be really clear, I'm not being an apologist for doing harmful things online or off, but I do think kids need to make the repair in the moment or in the community where it happens, not just a pro forma apology because they got caught, but really recognize and maybe do some further education as well for those kids. Maybe they didn't really understand the implications of referring to the Holocaust that way. Maybe the implications of white supremacy and the violence that entails weren't totally clear to them. And that's where we as school systems need to make sure we're showing up for our kids. When we see a kid use a slur or make a hateful gesture, we need to assume that they're the canary in the coal mine and this is happening in a more widespread way in the community. And we need to make sure we're teaching kids the history of why those practices and words and gestures are so harmful. Not just focus all our outrage on that one kid, but make sure the entire community is addressed and also make sure that the targeted community is supported, right? So we have a lot of work to do when a kid's mess up in that kind of way. And I think what we end up doing often is throwing that one kid or those group of kids under the bus and saying, oh, we had a racism problem here in Baraboo, but we got those kids. We found out those kids, let's share their faces everywhere. Instead of saying, wait a minute, like, do those kids not know the history? Where did we go wrong? And what can we do to support our neighbors who are targeted by this gesture?
Another thing that struck me about a communication gap that we talked about earlier, Devorah, is you talk to a lot of parents and a lot of youth. Parents often will say things like, it sounds like kids don't care about privacy anymore. But then when you talk to kids, it's a lot. There's a lot more nuance to how they think about privacy. What do you hear when you talk to teens who are using social media?
Kids will say that a practice is creepy if they find it creepy. So they'll say like someone going through all your old posts when they're your new friend is creepy and liking a really old post. Or they'll say that their parents, you know, sharing pictures of them or even worse, like reading their text is a real violation. So kids do care about privacy. The flip side is they're much more open about some things that in our generation were much more taboo and we didn't talk about. And that's one of the things I love about this generation is they are talking about mental health and other issues that we often kept private in our day. And even though like when I was a teenager, I did see a therapist, I never told my friends because I just figured it was taboo. Like no one ever told me, no, don't tell anyone you have a therapist. I just kind of like got the memo because it was the 90s and nobody talked about going to therapy. And now I love that it's an option that kids could say, I'm going to therapy. And let me be clear that I think it's still fine if someone wants to keep and chooses to keep that private. But I love living in a world where so many of these things are more destigmatized and a kid could potentially say to their friends, oh, got to bounce, I've got therapy. And that's some of the kinds of things they're disclosing online where we might say, oh, they're oversharing. But I want to challenge adults who say that kids are oversharing to think about, are they oversharing or are they changing the culture in a more open direction?
Talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You also have a chapter in your book devoted to concerns about sexting, which is maybe taking that openness to do things online a little too far. What do you want parents to know and talk to their kids about when it comes to sending sexually explicit images?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's illegal, right? So we know that. But it's more important to lean into the privacy and the social risks with kids with prevention, but we don't want to lean so far into prevention with sending nudes or explicit photos that our kids can't come to us if they have shared a photo, especially if that photo then is reshared without their consent, right? So I think I want to be clear, like, you know, none of us really want our kids to do this, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of privacy risks, there's legal risks, there's all kinds of risks. But it's especially important that kids don't coerce other kids into doing it or be coerced. And the research shows that the kids who experience the most mental distress and anguish are kids who get coerced or kids whose photos are shared outside of the original intended audience. In other words, two kids who are in love who exchange photos might not make us as parents happy, and it's not technically legal. But if no one ever is the wiser, the mental health outcomes are often fine, right? I mean, there's still the same risks as if those kids did other things together in a relationship. But what's important to understand is when kids are coerced or their photos are shared to a wider audience without consent, that's a tremendous violation that can lead to a lot of mental health issues for kids and a lot of social issues and stigma. Unfairly, even in 2023, we see this land on girls more often, where girls are shamed for their picture going around, whereas some boys will share pictures and not get shamed. Or boys will share pictures and girls will maybe find it yucky or block them but not report it. So there's just a tremendous double standard around this stuff. And I think we really need to proactively educate our kids around consent, making sure they know they should never coerce someone, that if they have had their photo shared and it's violating their privacy, that they deserve help and we still respect them. We're not so focused on prevention and shaming kids that we don't let kids know, hey, you have rights here. If your photo of yourself that you took and shared with one person that you trusted and that person violates your trust, they messed up and you have rights. And there are things that as an adult I can do to help protect you. I may never be able to get that photo back, let me be clear, but you know, we can get it taken down from any sites where it's been shared, especially because minors do have that right. And sites do not want to be hosting child pornography. So I think it's really important that our kids know that we still respect them, even if they've made a choice that maybe we're not jumping up and down about. If we lean too much into the fear factor with sexting, the worry I have as an educator and a parent is that kids won't come to us if they need us.
And just our last little over a minute or so, Devorah, one thing that often gets overlooked is that, hey, our teen years are times where we're experimenting with our identity. We're kind of trying on different things. And that's a lot of what is happening on social media. How big a part of the story is that?
It's absolutely part of the story. And one of the tricky things is kids will do things to get a rise out of their friends or be outrageous. You know, like I talked to some kids in Chicago who like, oh, it would be hilarious to like throw a gang sign and have a picture of me doing it. And they're not affiliated. They have nothing to do with any of that. But it's going to make them vulnerable to have shared that image. Right. I talked to a family where the kid had shared a picture of themselves with some vape stuff and the kid didn't even vape. He just thought it'd be hilarious to show with friends. And that's the tricky thing is with social, we're always talking to these different audiences and managing tremendously different contexts. And something that's funny to your three friends could get you in big trouble if someone else sees it. And that's so often what happens with social media. And it leads to, I think, tremendous misunderstandings and some consequences for kids that I think are often disproportionate to the intent of what they shared.
Devorah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Devorah Heitner is an author and speaker on technology and parenting in the digital age. We've been talking about her newest book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Still time for you to share what you've done in your own family, lessons you might like to share with others. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Remember, you can share this conversation. If there's somebody who you would like to have listen to some of the lessons from our guest today, find it in our program notes over at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming and our extensive archives. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.